In our series on the disputed letters of Paul, we are to the final group, the pastoral epistles. There are three letters in the group. The first two are addressed to Timothy, a young man Paul considered his chosen son. And the third is addressed to another helper of Paul's named Titus. Now, the reason these are treated as a group by scholars is because they're almost certainly written by the same person. May not be Paul, but it's by the same person. And there are some dead giveaways. First, they cover almost identical subject matter using the same phrases and words. And there is a lot of overlap between the three letters. Secondly, the author loves to pepper his writing with little proverbs, and he introduces each one by saying, "This is a trustworthy saying deserving of full acceptance." And then he says, you know, whatever little proverb he's going to say. Well, that phrase about this being a trustworthy saying is a phrase Paul never uses in any of his undisputed letters. And lastly, as with Colossians, Ephesians, and 2 Thessalonians, scholars tell us that the style of the Greek and the words used by the author of these pastoral epistles, are noticeably different than Paul's. So it's time to make your first call on your pastoral epistles scorecard, which hopefully you have ready. Should be the very first line there. And it's basically saying that that little phrase shows up five times in these three little letters, but zero times in anything else Paul wrote that we know of. Around 52 Common Era, Paul heads over to Lystra, which is where Timothy lives. And I suspect he picks Timothy up there on his way to the biggest city in the region, Ephesus. He and Timothy stay in Ephesus for 3 years before Paul is ready to head to Macedonia. Now, according to Acts 19:22, Paul sends Timothy and another man named Erastus on ahead to Macedonia. This is important, while Paul stays behind in Ephesus to wrap things up after having lived there for 3 years. Well, after they leave, Paul very nearly gets killed in a riot that is started by a craftsman named Demetrius, who makes his living selling silver shrines dedicated to Artemis, who is the goddess of the Ephesians. It's like their main attraction. Well, Demetrius thinks Paul's preaching is cutting into his profits. Demetrius whips up all the other guild members, and they start a riot against Paul. Paul is rescued by a city official and sets out for Macedonia, where he joins up with Timothy. Now, this bit about the riot is an important detail because in 2 Timothy in the pastoral epistles, the author refers to the harm done to him in Ephesus by Alexander the coppersmith. Alexander was presumably one of the guild members that Demetrius got riled up. And that means the pastoral epistles have to be written during or after this third missionary journey of Paul's. And that fits with the author's assertion in 2 Timothy 1:17 that this letter was written while Paul was imprisoned in Rome. And that happened after this third missionary journey that we're looking at on the map. So here's another point. Paul's other friend, Titus, was with him in Ephesus. Like Timothy, Titus had been with Paul since the very beginning of his ministry. Both men, both Timothy and Titus, were well-known associates of Paul's. So Paul sends his friend Titus from Ephesus to Corinth with yet another letter to the Corinthians. We don't have that letter. We only know about it from Paul's remarks of relief in 2 Corinthians 7 after Titus eventually catches up with Paul and gives him good news about the state of the church in Corinth, which had been a problem church from the beginning. So, to summarize, When Paul leaves Ephesus after the riot and travels to Macedonia, Timothy is already in Macedonia somewhere, and Titus is in Corinth. Paul arrives in Macedonia while Titus leaves Corinth and meets up with Paul in Macedonia and gives him good news about the Corinthians. The problem with the pastoral epistles is that they contradict all of this. They say Paul goes to Macedonia first and urges Timothy to stay back in Ephesus, completely backwards from the other accounts. Also, according to the pastoral epistles, Erastus somehow gets left in Corinth. There's not a lot of detail on that. While Paul leaves Titus in Crete. Crete? Yeah, you can see from the red line on the map, Paul doesn't even go to Crete on his third missionary journey. He goes the other direction entirely. Paul goes counterclockwise from Ephesus to Macedonia, and there is no record of Paul in Crete on any of his missions until all of his missionary journeys are over and he's a prisoner being transported to Rome. His transport ship stops in Crete. Titus would not have been on that transport ship of prisoners. So the logistics of the pastoral epistles simply don't work compared to Acts or Corinthians. Time to update your scorecard. The only way any of the pastoral epistles' version of the story works is if Paul leaves Rome alive and makes a fourth big missionary journey around the Mediterranean, this time traveling clockwise. The problem with that theory is that in his authentic letters, Paul insists that if he is able to leave Rome, he will travel directly west to Spain because he's run out of places to bring the good news to the areas he's already been. Time to mark your scorecard again. On the other hand, 2 Timothy does end with a bunch of news and personal details. The author complains from Rome that he's been deserted by Demas, Crescens, and even Titus. He says only Luke is with him and asks Timothy to bring Mark when he comes. He also asks for Timothy to bring him the cloak and the scrolls and parchments he left in Troas. He ends with greetings to several well-known friends of Paul's, familiar names like Priscilla and Aquila and Erastus. So this is on the maybe it is Paul side of the ledger. So mark your scorecard for this. Then there are the things Paul supposedly says about himself in 1 Timothy. In chapter 1, he thanks Jesus Christ for considering him faithful enough to be appointed to ministry. But then he says he used to be a blasphemer, a persecutor, and arrogant. Now, this might be how others saw Paul in his early days of persecuting the Christians. I can totally believe others would see Paul as arrogant. He definitely comes across that way. But Paul himself never thought more highly of himself than he should have, at least from the writings we have that describe his inner thoughts. He was seriously accomplished and extremely smart, and he did not suffer people looking down on him. But in his writings, there is a strong thread of humility, which is the earmark of someone who has spent their lifetime following God. Before his Damascus Road experience, perhaps others might have called Paul a blasphemer, especially against Christ. But Paul never describes himself like that. In Paul's authentic letters, he consistently talks about how carefully he observed the law before he knew Christ. In my opinion, he would never have described himself as a blasphemer at any point in his life. He always had the utmost reverence for God. But you may not agree. Did he consider himself a blasphemer while he was persecuting the Christians? Time to mark your scorecard. And that brings us to dating these letters. By their own admission, they are written after Paul is imprisoned in Rome. And that we know occurred around 61 to 63 Common Era. Historically, we can see that they are included in the Muratorian Canon, a list of books considered canon that was compiled around 180 Common Era. So we know the pastoral epistles had to have been written sometime in between these two dates. And I agree with scholars who date them more towards the end of this time range than the earlier part. And that's because of the letter's references to Gnostic teachings, which did not become popular until around the middle of the second century. To help you visualize this, here's a little timeline that starts with Jesus' crucifixion. Paul's ministry begins then. And of course, that's when he writes all his authentic letters. Most of the Gospels and the other New Testament books are written near or after Paul's death. During the first half of the second century, some more of the New Testament books are written, and the church fathers begin to realize they need to start collecting these books and deciding which ones are canon and which ones are not. But that process is only just beginning around the time the pastoral epistles are written. Christianity won't have a solid canon, what we now call the Bible, for at least 200 more years. In the middle of the second century, roughly 100 years after Paul's death, there is a soup of popular theology stirring around the Christian communities. Now, this soup includes Greek philosophy, such as Platonism, that see the physical body as a shadow of the spiritual reality. Marcion was extremely influential, really big in these early Christian communities. And he taught that the creator God of the Hebrew Bible was harsh and cruel, and that Jesus came to reveal the true God of love. It's like he sees it as two different gods, guys. This is also when Gnosticism began to become very popular in Christian circles. The Greek word gnosis is the base word for knowledge. So Gnosticism means knowing and is referring to those in the know. Gnostic Christians taught that Jesus gave the apostles a secret knowledge that had been passed down only to the Gnostics. All of these theologies would have been attractive to Christians for one reason or another, and many of the New Testament books that were not written by Paul were written in part as a response to all these various philosophies or different ones of these theologies, and to the quote, false teachers who were teaching these other theologies. Gnosticism in particular had a far-reaching impact. I don't know why it is, but people tend to want to belong to the club with the secret handshake, right? We want to be part of the in crowd, the folks who know something the rest of the schmucks don't know. It makes us feel more important than them. And that should be your first big red flag when faced with this sort of theology. Christianity is a theology of humility and of thinking of others as being as important as yourself. Christianity is a theology that embraces pouring ourselves out for others. It is a theology that trusts God's love for us all, rather than our own secret code to get into the door of heaven. Now, before I give you an overview of Gnosticism, I need to let you know that the source for what I'm sharing here about Gnosticism is a book, the textbook, The New Testament, A Historical Introduction to the Early Christian Writings by Dr. Bart D. Ehrman, a famous and prolific New Testament scholar. The particular edition I consulted is the sixth edition published by Oxford University Press in 2016, though I believe there have been more editions of this particular text since then. It's truly outstanding. And although I'm not directly quoting Dr. Ehrman, I am drawing the material from his work in chapter 12, pages 205 through 210. Any mistakes are my own. First off, not all Gnostics were Christians. So I'm obviously going to focus on the beliefs of the ones who were Christian, the Christian Gnostics. Even within Christian Gnosticism, there were several different streams of belief. So keep in mind that the following statements I'm about to make are broad generalizations. First, Gnostics generally believed that although there is one ultimate God, there are lots of what they called eons, which are sort of lesser divine beings that capture the essence of various of God's characteristics, like reason, grace, wisdom. These would be personified as eons. And they believed the creator God of the Hebrew Bible was one of these lesser divine beings and an ignorant and inferior one at that. In fact, they believed his screwing up is why there's evil and suffering in the world and why we are far away from the spiritual world above. Gnostics believed that the human soul is connected to the divine, but we have become oblivious to this connection. That actually sounds right. Some streams of Gnosticism thought all human souls have this divine connection, while other streams thought it was only certain human souls that did, and that those who did not have this special divine connection were no better than animals. Yikes, you know where that leads. Christian Gnostics believed that Jesus Christ, who they did acknowledge as divine, came from the spiritual realm to the human souls who do have this divine connection, or quote, immortal soul, so as to awaken them to the knowledge that they come from the divine. That was the big secret, that you come from the divine. And this secret knowledge is then expanded upon by the Gnostics in elaborate myths that explain the ultimate God, the eons, the spiritual realm, the physical world, and humans. And I'm not kidding when I say elaborate. They had names for all the characters, complex stories of how the spiritual realm is structured, myths about the origin and evolution of God. It's as complex as Greek mythology, really. And of course, each stream of Christian Gnosticism had their own version of this. And many of these Gnostic teachers taught that their knowledge was hidden in the Hebrew Bible, especially in the story of Adam and Eve. Salvation to them was a complex understanding of our divine souls being trapped in our physical bodies and needing urgently to return to the heavenly realm. And at least for some Gnostics, baptism was seen as a mystic ritual that enabled this return to the heavenly realm, this salvation to happen. So the basic understanding of Christian Gnostics may seem like very like Orthodox Christianity on the surface, the connection to the divine, Jesus saving us by bringing us this knowledge. You can see how confusing it might be to a new believer back in the day the pastoral epistles were written. You could see someone trying to explain one of Paul's letters and sounding very much like this, right? The main way of telling whether the teacher was teaching Gnosticism was by noticing the elaborate myths they were teaching. The pastoral epistles are written from the point of view of an apostle warning a young pastor about what to look for and how to combat it. So as we go through the pastoral epistles, we will be watching for signs that the author was responding to this soup of theologies and to the rise of Gnosticism in particular. We're not going to go through the pastoral epistles letter by letter because they're very similar and they repeat themselves. Instead, we'll approach them by topic. And there are three main topics: false teachers, such as Gnostics, those teaching a return to the Mosaic Law, other false teachers, church governance, and household governance. And honestly, overlaying all of these is a very strong sense of control. The author wants the entire believing community to be ruled with an iron grip, with respect, but with absolute control. Let's look at what he has to say about the false teachers first. These false teachers are apparently a big problem. The author warns that they spend their time talking about godless myths, endless genealogies, that the law must be followed, including circumcision, and abstaining from certain foods, that believers should not get married, telling old wives' tales, creating envy, generating foolish and unhealthy controversies, arguing over wording, and some of them are only pretending to be godly so they can get your money. You can definitely see Gnostic influence in a bunch of these that I've highlighted in purple. The endless myths and controversies and arguments and generating envy when one clique thinks they're better than everybody else. You can also see the influence in green of those who are teaching the return to the Mosaic Law. These are even a couple of guys in, there are even a couple of guys in the letter to Titus who are teaching that the resurrection has already happened, which causes all sorts of consternation on the part of the believers. See what a melting pot this second century of Christianity was? And these are the points that are being made in these pastoral epistles. The author says, "You must put a stop to this or it will spread like gangrene. These false teachers must be silenced." Most of the time, the author tells Timothy to counteract these teachers by persistently teaching the truth and not letting anyone look down on him just because he's young. By shunning such people, rebuking them sharply, and not having anything to do with them, and by living a good example. But in Titus 1, the author totally goes off on the people living on the Isle of Crete, which is where Titus is supposedly ministering. He says, "Every one of Crete's own prophets, Epimenides being one of them, said, 'Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, and lazy gluttons.'" Like, ouch, right? And truly, according to the notes in my NIV study Bible, this idea of Cretans being liars was prevalent in the ancient world because they taught that Zeus had died and that they had his tomb. Isn't that interesting? This derision survives even today. Even today, we sometimes hear someone uncivilized and brutish being called a Cretan. Comes from here. But this to me does not sound like Paul. Paul never attacked whole communities like this. He reserved his harsh language for those who were leading others astray. But he found good even in pagan societies. There's lots of examples of this. The Gentiles were his mission field. So we have two things to mark on our scorecard. First, the mentions of people teaching what appears to be influenced by the rising tide of Gnosticism. So if they're responding to these ideas that didn't happen until nearly 100 years after Paul's death, Paul couldn't have written these letters. And second, these broad, hateful remarks about all Cretans. So mark your scorecards. Before we move on, I want to address a clobber passage found in 1 Timothy 1, 8 through 11. This is the last of the so-called clobber verses in the Bible. It's found in a passage that specifically addresses false teachers who are teaching that the believers must follow the Mosaic law. The author says, "We know the law is good if used as intended. It is not intended for the righteous, but for the wicked and anything opposed to sound teaching." Now, where I have the words "the wicked," the author inserts a typical vice list intended to paint a general picture of whatever is really, really wicked in the world. Now, this particular list includes the lawless and rebellious, the unholy and the profane, murderers, the sexually immoral, the word there is pornoi, slave traders and human traffickers, and liars and false witnesses. Now that's a pretty heavy-duty list of wickedness, isn't it? These sorts of people, these would not show the gifts of the Spirit, right? No fruit of gentleness, patience, humility, love, self-control, peace. None of that. So now let's look at the other thing included in this list. It's a very rare Greek word, arsenikoitai, and it literally means male bedder. Your Bible may translate this as homosexual, but right off the bat, from the very context in which this word is used, we can see that it cannot possibly mean homosexuals, because we know from direct experience in our own lives that the LGBTQ plus among us are so often gentle and kind and compassionate and open and full of faith and goodness. That's not what's being talked about here. In fact, this entire vice list would cut across all sexual orientations, wouldn't it? Heterosexuals, as well as someone on the LGBTQ plus spectrum, right? Being unholy or profane has nothing whatever to do with sexual orientation. Neither do the rest of these vices. What these vices do have in common is being the fruit of absolute evil that can certainly be exhibited by heterosexuals. So if we can see that this family of vices is not limited to heterosexuals or homosexuals, then what does this weird Greek word mean? Based on the other vices, arsenikoitai must be something particularly vile. For help with this, I turned to Walking the Bridgeless Canyon by Kathy Baldock, Kenyon Walker Press, 2014. Her work is well researched, and in the part where she talks about this, she also cites Arsenikoites and Malakos, Meaning and Consequences, by Dale B. Martin in Biblical Ethics and Homosexuality, Listening to Scripture, edited by Robert L. Brawley and published by Westminster John Knox Press in 1996. What's crazy is that according to Kathy Baldock's research, which I believe is also based on that of Dale B. Martin, the word arsenikoitai is used less than 100 times in over 600 years of Greek literature, which includes some of the centuries after Paul. Think how much literature was generated in that 600 years, and this word shows up less than 100 times. So our understanding of this word, even from the contemporary Greek literature, is going to be sketchy at best. It's not a word you want to hang a major theology from. In almost all translations of Greek literature outside of the Bible prior to the 1500s, the word is most closely connected with exploitive sex for money. It also, just simply appears in other vice lists. And this actually makes sense. Historically, we know that under the ancient patronage system, this was a thing. A richer patron would take a younger teen under his wing, so to speak, sometimes at the request of the younger man's family. Supposedly, the patron would shower benefits on the younger man and mentor him. But as you can imagine, it was also a model of domination, and it could turn dark. It often turned into pederasty. Outside of the Bible, this word, arsenikoitai, is used in the context of a power imbalance and sex. It has to do with a man using sex to dominate another man. It has absolutely nothing to do with sexual attraction and everything to do with rape, abuse, aggression, and dominance against someone powerless to stop you. Aside from pederasty, in which the child is being used as an object, the other example that comes to mind is a heterosexual man raping a captured man as an act of war. This is evil. Also, notice the word itself, male better. It's not talking about women at all. But we know, of course, that women can be homosexual. But this vice clearly does not apply to women in the mind of the author. If arsenikoitai were addressing homosexuality, it would have to be addressed to both men and women, and it is not. In this case, whatever activity this word describes, it is definitely a vice of the worst kind. I'm not sure we have a single English word that would work here, but I'm equally sure that it is not homosexuality. Far from it. This whole list is a broad brush picture of the entirely wicked and depraved, including heterosexuals, not someone who is a believer and whose life exhibits the fruit of the Spirit, as do so many of our homosexual siblings. So we've covered false teachers. The next big topic addressed in the pastoral epistles is church governance. And this feeds right into the need the author sees for the pastor to have iron-fisted control over the church. And this seems like a good place to stop for the day. We'll finish up the pastoral epistles next week. In our breakout groups today, we're going to talk about false teachers then and now. Julie got on early. It popped her out of the group, and she was asking me, who is the they who thought that the pastoral epistles were written by Paul? And I was saying, it's just tradition handed down generationally in the church. So, in these different regions. So, I can't give you a name, but certainly, that was the understanding was that these were written by Paul. So I'm just giving you, we're looking at the textual evidence to look at this tradition and say, well, wait a minute. Did this get handed down correctly? What is the internal evidence? What is the contextual evidence? What is the linguistic evidence that we can see?
And see, that leads me down a whole different way of how much of the Bible is handed down and interpretations. And I don't want to take over the group with that, but that's one of the things with the Bible that always is in my mind of how many years later these books were written and letters and okay, thank you. I won't take up any more time. Thank
No,
you.
that's okay. And the thing is, the copies, obviously these are copies of copies. We don't have any originals of any books, but the copies are very consistent through the ages and across the regions. So they were fairly faithfully copied. We can compare manuscripts and see some changes, but the changes that we see are small, and but that still doesn't tell us who wrote it.
But did the councils, I think that's when I'm probably the person who was saying they a lot. Whoop, sorry about that. But the they I have in my head, I'm saying is like the councils and the people who every time went through everything deciding what was going to be in the Bible, you know, which books and things like that is my understanding. Did
Well, those that
they put a stamp on who they thought that was, or was that even part of that
No, it
consideration?
absolutely was. Although that
Okay.
was not their main criteria, their criteria was, is the theology that's being taught useful?
Consistent, yeah.
You know,
And
and
well, I'm sorry, Gail, go ahead.
no, that's okay.
And then I get into thinking, well, you know, it's easy now to think, oh, okay, everybody's just copying things with the copy machine, Xerox, as we used to come in, whatever they used to, but these were all handwritten by scribes. They didn't have all that. So I could just, I don't know, my mind gets out there going all with all the what ifs of things not actually being copied correctly,
Well,
possibly.
there was quality control over the copying, because typically these guys worked in monasteries under supervision, and there was checking and rechecking that was happening. We do see, and we can tell by comparing different manuscripts of the same letter, we can see where one guy fell asleep and started again and repeated a phrase, you know, that kind of thing. The things that are wrong are kind of obvious. We can see where they erased Junia's name and changed it to a male version. You know, we can see some of the we can see the thing, and they would write in the margins. You know, it's like pretty obvious where the changes are made. And certainly, if you lined up, if we all sat down and copied a letter, we would make mistakes. But if we lined them all up, we'd have a really good idea of what the original said. And that's how these books came to be. So we're
But
not
even back
talking so
then,
much about what's in them as what their provenance was. And their provenance was that these copies had been passed around in all over the region and were in use and read in worship, in the Christian gatherings. And different leaders in these regions began keeping lists of which ones of these letters they thought were really helpful and which ones were not so helpful. And then, so when they did finally have the councils, the people who got invited to those councils are these leaders in these churches who had their own ideas and their lists, and then they would come together and they would talk about things like that. Although I have to say that the councils did not focus on what should be in the Bible and what shouldn't. They just didn't have that concept of the Bible. What these councils, these really famous councils, focused on was the theology, in particular, of the divinity of Jesus, whether there was such a thing as the Trinity, whether Jesus was all human and not divine, or whether Jesus was divine, all divine and not human, or whether he was a mixture of the two, or whether he was divine and he emptied himself of the divine and became all human. And I mean, they fought tooth and nail over this stuff and came up with special words in particular order to say that Jesus was the same substance as the Father. And I mean, these creeds that we now say in our churches are so carefully worded. And that wording, what you see in the Nicene Creed, the Apostles' Creed, these creeds are the things that these councils focused on, not whether this letter was written by Paul. Renee.
My one question is, are there I actually have two questions. My first one is, you said there were no writings of like from antiquity of the ones that actually wrote it, you know, or did the stuff like diaries or anything like that.
I'm lost. And so what there was in antiquity was people did a lot of writing. A lot of people did a lot of writing, and there is a lot of literature, okay? Like Homer, and Odysseus, and I mean there's just all the Greek mythology, there's just tons of writing, and there's normal everyday writing. We have records of letters and household memorandum, and we have political records and laws, and just there's a huge body of Greek literature from that region from this time. What we don't have for the books of the Bible are any of the originals of those particular letters.
Okay, gotcha. Is that the same with the Old Testament too, or just the New
Yes.
Testament? It's both
Yes.
of them.
The same.
Interesting.
Julia.
I have a question. Remember when there was a ruler that called all the clerics together and put them in little caves and had them write out? Was that the Old Testament only, or the Old and New Testament?
Are you talking about the Septuagint?
Yes.
Okay, so that is a story, which may or may not be true, of a ruler gathering 70 scholars and having them, do this a Greek translation of the Hebrew text, okay, of the Hebrew Bible. So he had 70 scholars supposedly each translate the Hebrew text. And supposedly, these 70 scholars all came up with the exact same translation. Isn't that a miracle? And
That's where our inerrancy doctrine came from.
yes. And that is why the Septuagint is abbreviated. It's not abbreviated SEPT like you would think it would be from its name. It's abbreviated LXX, which is the Roman numeral for 70.
When was that done?
Oh, don't ask me hard questions. Google
Okay,
it.
sorry. I'm going.
I do know that the Septuagint was the version. It was done pre-Christ,
Oh,
not
okay.
long pre-Christ, recently pre-Christ. But it was enough pre-Christ, long enough before that, that that Greek version of the Hebrew Bible was in circulation and was the scripture that Jesus, the apostles, the disciples, that the Christians used and had. And we know that because there are subtle differences between the Septuagint version and the Masoretic text, which is the one that our Bibles are based on. So, and those differences show up in many of the quotes that the New Testament writers used. So we know they were using the Septuagint version, the Greek version of the Hebrew Bible.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm showing off.
So am I.
Donna wrote a note that the Septuagint was written in stages, starting with the Pentateuch, which was the first five books, around the mid-third century BCE. Yes, in Ptolemaic Egypt. Ptolemaic is like the name of the rulers. And the rest of the Hebrew Bible was translated by the end of first century BCE. That is true. This collection of texts was translated into Koine Greek, which was the common Greek of the day. That's what they say next, to make the Hebrew scriptures accessible to the large Hellenistic or Greek Jewish community. And Septuagint, that's the tradition about the Jewish scholars, the 72 Jewish scholars. Where did you get that, Donna? Who am I quoting here?
Quoting AI.
AI, wonderful.
No,
Okay.
just a Google.
Take it with
I Googled it in a summary, and at least
You
what it
did
said.
good. You take it with a grain of salt.
Well, I know exactly. I was going to say until the big timelines. I've been looking at the overview things they give, but I definitely give it a grain of salt. This is mainly Encyclopedia Britannica.
Yeah, which is a source that I use in my research.
Yeah, so I would say it
Encyclopedia
shows
Britannica. Yeah,
different things in
the
there.
and that mid-third century BCE is just about is right. A lot of what we have is from there. Marlene.
This is just a silly question.
No,
But
sir.
if there were 72 Jewish scholars in the room, why is it LXX and not
I have no idea, because
It has two writers. Did they get locked out?
I
Or
know that's
what
great.
are
They were supplying the wine.
they AI?
So what y'all talk about in your group? What's your verdict? We're only about halfway through the pastoral epistles, but what did you think? So far, do you think they're written by Paul?
No.
Nope.
Yeah, I didn't either.
We don't
Now,
even know if Paul exists.
I did come up with one potential idea, although the timing is off. I think the timing is one of the biggest things. You know, what you said about the timeline in terms of where they were written, that to me is kind of the nail in the coffin as far as deciding. But if that had not been the case, the one thought that came to me as a nurse is that I remember that there was a time when Paul was beaten so badly that he almost died and probably suffered a traumatic brain injury, and that can lead to personality changes.
Oh, but that was very early in his ministry. Very
Yeah,
early. That was Lystra
so
and
that would
Derbe.
be about the only
His missionary
rationale that
journey.
I could come up with if it weren't for the timeline,
Yeah. But
why
that
this
would
would be
have
so
affected all of
inconsistent.
his letters because it was that early in his ministry.
Okay.
So, good thought.
So that throws that thought out. So I
Yeah.
go back to
Yeah.
no.
No, it's a good way to think. I love that you are thinking like that. I love that we're thinking about context. It makes such a difference. Makes such a difference. So if the pastoral epistles were not written by Paul, then they were written by somebody else. And this somebody else describes false teachers as all kinds of nasty, terrible things that they desert the faith and devote themselves to teachings of demons, and they're lying hypocrites, and they don't have consciences, and if they don't believe and teach the things I've taught you, then they don't agree with the words of Jesus Christ, and their minds are defiled, and their consciences are defiled, and they say they know God, but they really don't, and they're being just detestable and disobedient, and they're unfit for any good work. Now, if this guy was not Paul, was he a false teacher himself?
It sure sounds like some big churches I can think of.
Yeah. We talked about that in our group.
Good.
And my own take is, given that it was not uncommon for someone to write in someone else's name at the time, I don't get the sense that this was someone who was trying to deliberately mislead people away from the teachings of Paul or Jesus, but he certainly had a different spin on it and was much more probably a man of the culture in terms of the patriarchy and the top-down control structure, and pretty spicy guy in terms of what he had to say
Pull any
about other
punches.
people. But yeah, like Julie said, reminds me of a lot of current so-called Christian leaders.
Well, you can't you be a false teacher? If you even if you don't consciously know that you're trying to be false, if the message that you're giving is in fact contrary in some ways to Jesus' ministry and teaching, doesn't that make you a false teacher, even if you're not consciously trying to be false?
What do y'all think?
I would agree with you, Woody. If it was my definition, yes, I think he's a false teacher. But by his own definition, I would say
His
no.
harsh definition? No.
Yeah.
I think Julia and then Renee.
Oh, I was going to say, I don't see it black and white. I see it like there was a lot going on that they were, sorry. They were trying to address. And we don't have all that context in the letter itself. We don't have things that we learned today in that letter. It came extraneous influences that bring us here. So I don't think they were trying to be bad teachers or false teachers, but I do see where it sure walks the line all throughout. There is some things that seem to be redeeming on occasion. I can't find them off the top of my head. Renee.
Okay. Mine kind of goes back to both of those thoughts. I've been having a discussion with one of my friends about how if you're raised a certain way, you're going to teach your children that certain way. And that's going to make those children, if it's a bad way, it's something most people think is bad, your children aren't going to know that it's not bad until they learn about it. You're not inherently being bad on purpose. You just don't know any better. And with what Julia was saying is the scribes were probably writing down something somebody was quoting, maybe. So it could have just been that, yes, they were unintentionally false prophets, but they were also not in power.
Any other observations, Julia?
Julia, can't get my hand up right. Renee, that brings a thought. I've been staying with my son's family, and when I raised my son, I grew up in a very harsh, difficult environment, and I wanted to make sure that wouldn't happen with my kids. So I yelled as a discipline. And now that I'm older and I'm, he was my first and I'm four kids in now, I see that as unacceptable. And I see that he yells. And while I was there for 4 months, I tried to model not yelling and being effective and lowering my voice and those other things, and talking to my grandchildren to get them to understand why I was disappointed in something or frustrated at something, but that I still loved them the whole time, because they would react extremely contrite and upset, and they were missing the message a lot of times. So what you were saying about raising your children and not realizing that that was not the best way to do something, sometimes it takes you getting in there for kids to figure it out. And I finally did, so my grandchildren can benefit, but
Yeah, and that's kind of what's going on with this author, perhaps, is he's speaking from his own understanding and context, right? Which is a very controlling context. I mean, we've only done false teachers, and we're about to get to church governance and house governance, and that's where the control part really comes out. But he sees other people. He sees a real danger to the church. He sees a danger to these new Christian communities, and he's not wrong. Okay. And he's in there fighting to try to, say, don't listen to this stuff. It's not right. Now, the way he's doing it is by demonizing the other guys and tearing them down. That probably would not be the way I'd go about trying to convince somebody, not to follow a teacher, but that's the way he sees things, black and white. But I don't know that I see him. Julia and I were our own little small group, and we were talking about how we don't really necessarily see him as black and white as he sees the other guys.
I think if he were to write it now, he might, with everything that has happened because of those voices, the context might be different because a lot of harm often comes from these kind of verses. And that wasn't the intention, I don't think.
No, I think his heart was in the right place, Marlene.
Yeah, and that takes me back to the issue I've had for many, many years with so many pastors and church teaching about the Bible, that it is number one, inerrant, that it is number two, was dictated by God through human hands and cannot possibly have error, is perfect and is to be, put on the altar. Figuratively, and worshiped as quote unquote the capital W word of God. Because the depth of study that this journey we've been on together shows that these were human beings that were writing, that were, inspired by the love of God, some instructed directly by Jesus. That they were doing their very best to follow what they understood of God, but they were also human. And that we can't look at these passages and say, well, the Bible says, and the Bible is perfectly clear, and therefore that is the inarguable truth, because we'd tie ourselves in knots trying to reconcile conflicting passages, trying to say that what is in some of these passages is not harmful. And so it's so hard that so much of modern American or Western Christianity has elevated the Bible to this place of being akin to God's word spoken from God's, very being, and therefore you can't argue with them.
I saw Anne nodding her head. I'm curious to know what she's thinking.
Somehow this all reminds me a little bit of the current political situation. It's that people can have honest and genuine beliefs that are totally opposite. Does that make one of the other of them
That's
a false
exactly.
prophet, false teacher?
Good-hearted and well-intentioned people can have this, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And
So I have a story. Understand, I worked in a ghetto school. It was very, very poor, and we changed principals like I change underwear, every 6 months or so. And so we get this young buck who comes in. He's 30, 32 years old. He's going to be our new principal. He knows everything, by God. And so in speaking to us when we first met him, he is jumping around like a maniac and, telling us, "Oh, I'm 51 and look at me, I can jump up and down the bleachers." And then he goes on to present to the kids in that same manner. And so the kids come to me and they're like, "Wow, Mr. Garcia is 51 years old. So Miss Mack, what are you, like 95?" And I go, "So he wasn't trying to do this to be malicious. He was trying to get us pumped up. But the message that came out, kind of harshly judged some of us who were not 95 years old. And I think a lot of this can occur, although I am a bit skeptical. I'm afraid these peckerheads put this in the Bible because they wanted to keep control to a certain group of people. And that's where it gets scary."
Amen.
That's what I think.
Yeah, Martha, did you have something? You have to turn your mic on, though.
In our group, I came to a similar thought as Anne did, that it served a purpose. It justified a lot of the need of the people who were there to be the people who would be able to continue with their power and influence. That said, even though sometimes I do think that people do really know what they're doing, they also may have just been acting the way they knew to act. Doesn't mean it was helpful, but doesn't necessarily mean it was malicious.
Yes, that's it.
Has it had some really negative impact? You betcha.
Yeah. And I think that in the presentation, I had these big red flags, because at the point that things begin to diverge and move into control and elaborate rules and elaborate theologies and blah, 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 and it starts to get embellished. When you see embellishments like that, those should raise red flags, because Jesus Christianity, I mean, Jesus wasn't a Christian, you know that, right? Jesus was a Jew, but Jesus' teaching was very simple and very earthy. And so was Paul's. When you get right down to it, it was treat each other right. Pay attention to your own junk. Don't judge the other guys, and God, and let God have it. Let God be God and you worry about you. And so when we get too far from that, we start, and I feel like these pastoral epistles are kind of moving away from that and become, as Martha points out, more able to be used as tools against us. It would be hard to use Jesus' teachings as tools against us.
And they're still being used against us. For all of the people who are still fans of James Dobson just died. He is our contemporary.
Yeah, and he would have fit right in with these pastoral epistles.
Oh, and I used to
Oh yeah.
listen to
Oh
him,
yeah.
and that's the whole thing. Over time, the things that you said and were involved in, and that was the good thing. And then you keep learning and go, well, I feel like the intent was good,
Yeah.
but then can be used for all sorts of other things. So
Yeah.
anyway, that's.
Yeah. Exactly. And so I just try. It's kind of like looking at the when we need to stop. It's like looking at this particular author of these pastoral epistles and being willing to see him in a more nuanced light than he was using on everybody else. He saw everybody else in black and white. And I want us to be ready to recognize his humanity and glean from what he said the things that are helpful, and not get bludgeoned by the things that may have been contextual to him in particular or to his time frame. So, great class, guys. Any last comments?
Don't throw the baby
Okie
out with the bathwater. No.
Yeah,
Don't go throw
okay.
the bathwater on the baby.
That's exactly right. Well, we will finish up the pastoral epistles and this whole series next week. See you then.
Bye, y'all.
Bye,
Bye.
y'all.